Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
That loud sound was saying, I'm not Dick Staub. I'm Jenny Spohr. I'm taking over the big chair tonight.
Yay, Jenny.
Yes. I do produce the show and occasionally, you know, blabber on it. So hopefully you're familiar with my voice, but I'm glad to be here and happy to have all of you here tonight. This is our kickoff to our fall season 2011 at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub, our flagship show. Coming to you from Seattle on a beautiful night.
Yes.
Solar flares and everything, hopefully not disturbing our technical equipment. And that's actually a perfect solar flares
there
may
go.
Play into our topic
yes,
tonight,
absolutely.
Which is Terrence Malick's new film, The Tree of Life. It has been called a masterpiece to some, drivel to others. It has been called the most overtly Christian mainstream picture since The Passion of the Christ. One reviewer described the film this way. He said, he takes us on a journey from the very birth of the universe to its current flawed state, with a stopover to a family in a small town in Texas circa 1950. So it's a wide, long journey. We have a lot to talk about tonight and a lot cut out for us. I'm joined tonight by our esteemed film panel with author, critic, blogger extraordinaire, Jeffrey Overstreet.
Woo-hoo. Yay.
His latest book, Ale Boys Feast, is out, of course. Purchasable anywhere except Borders.
Except
they're not around anymore. Don't even try that one. And Jeffrey tells me that there are people actually brewing the Ale Boys beer.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, you cannot get it because they're home brews. But I don't know. Maybe they could email you and find out how they could get their own little almost pirated copy of the
Feel free to ask.
Yeah, okay. Jeffrey's also brought some copies, of course, of Through a Screen Darkly, which is his wonderful nonfiction about a film. And he's got some of those copies on sale tonight and still on the sale again everywhere but Borders. And we have the lovely chair of the English department and world traveler.
That's me.
Dr. Chris Chaney. Welcome. Let's have a round of applause for these guys. Okay, so before we get started, guys, how was your summer? Anything interesting
to
report?
Well, I was traveling the world, so...
You were?
What can I say?
What's your highlight from that?
Highlight was being in Northern Ireland, actually, most of July at Corrymeela, some of you might know, on the coast. An amazing, amazing reconciliation place. It's been around since the 60s, and it's been doing incredible work on broken communities in Northern Ireland and all over the world. World renowned. So it was wonderful. Plus, it was about 80 degrees, and there's a beach. You can see Scotland. Mm. It was amazing.
Wow.
So
lovely.
I'm lucky.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, sir.
Mine started with a writing conference at a place called Laity Lodge near Kerrville, Texas, in the hill country of Texas.
Oh.
Beautiful,
wow.
Beautiful
yes.
place. Okay.
Got some Texans here.
That was a fantastic time. And soon after that, my wife Anne, her first book of poetry was published.
Yes.
And she will be reading from that at the big release party at Elliott Bay Bookstore on Friday night. So
wonderful.
If you're interested in a party, there are two poets reading that night. And I hear it's going to be more than just reading. It's going to be music. And I even heard rumors of acrobats, but I'm not sure if that's happening.
Why?
Poetry, acrobats.
Poetry and acrobats.
I'm not making that up. It's,
wow.
It's very strange.
Yeah, the only combination that's not in the Tree of Life. Acrobatics with poetry.
We did have levitation, though.
Yes, we did have levitation, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Okay, now, before we get into this specific film, I want to talk about Terrence Malick as a director. Now, you guys have seen all of his previous four films. Now, is he just a misunderstood genius, or is he an overblown emperor with no clothes?
Ooh.
Jeffrey, what do
Yikes.
You think?
Are those our only two choices?
Yeah, he could
yes.
be
yeah.
or C.
Yes,
you know, what,
right.
yeah.
Well, he's made five movies, but that's going back to the early 70s. So I think we're still finding out who Terrence Malick is. We could get into his biography, but he strives, unlike most filmmakers, to be fairly private. And and I want to honor that to some extent. I mean, you can say he grew up in Texas, had a childhood somewhat like what we see in The Tree of Life. You can say that it's fairly well known that he had a brother who committed suicide, and a lot of the grief about the death of a family member in this movie is clearly tied to his own wrestling with those hard questions and with that loss. You can talk about the fact that he went and studied Heidegger at Harvard, Oxford, and he went and actually translated Heidegger. So he's much more interested in philosophy than narrative.
Sure, for those of us who are not Heidegger experts, because can either one of you give us a little bit of a
oh dear.
I think maybe that I better do that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Since I teach
Heidegger. Chris. Yes. Since you teach it.
Yes, please. Right. Well, the short version would just be that he's a phenomenologist of the early 20th century. So that school of thought is about the horizon of experience and the way in which human knowing can be articulated best that takes consciousness and, you know, the vista, lived experience, both together. So sort of in response to that hyper-materialist or hyper-rationalist enlightenment thought. Mm-hmm. So Heidegger is a crucial, major philosopher in all of Western thought. But I love that it's about the lived horizon of experience. And I think that's key for what we see in Malick, for sure.
Absolutely. And he, you know, he's critically acclaimed with his first film out, Badlands. Mm-hmm. I mean, already he has anticipation with the very first film he does. Let's talk a little bit about Badlands.
Well, it starred a young Martin Sheen, who still speaks of that experience very, very highly, and Sissy Spacek. There's some interesting essays about Heidegger and Badlands and how you've got sort of a Bonnie and Clyde. You've got this young couple on the run, not just from their families, but from a cultural norm, and how he doesn't judge them.
No.
How he is as likely to bring the camera around to the beauty of the nature they're hiding out in as he is to address their criminal behavior. And he never really portrays them as horrible people, just kind of lost and trying to find themselves in a world that's telling them what to be. And you really sort of fall for these characters as wrong as they might be.
Right. And no male filmmaker has ever channeled teenage girl diary writing as better. If you've seen Badlands, the voiceover, Sissy Spacek character, and her flat narration of what her wedding is going to be like and her boyfriend and her future, this and that. I mean, to me, it's jaw-dropping how much he is channeling a sort of 15-year-old girl in that narrative style. It's incredible.
He does it again in Days of Heaven, the next movie. And that's something, actually, if we get around to talking about if there's any lack in The Tree of Life. One of the things I love about Badlands and Days of Heaven is those monologues have such distinct character voices.
Right.
And one of the criticisms we hear the most about The Tree of Life is that the voiceover is just sort of this sort of bland, universal human voice, and that's harder to connect with.
Sort of just out there. Yeah. Now, Jeffrey, you're a huge fan of New World.
I mean, that's huge, doesn't even begin to describe it.
This is his film.
Yeah.
So,
what
is it that makes you such a fan of that film in particular?
Well, there's a lot of things, and the director's cut, which is 45 minutes longer than what a lot of people described as an endless nightmare. it explores the story of who we call Pocahontas, but that name I think came later. They call her Rebecca in the movie. And she meets these newcomers and falls for the explorer, the captivating John Smith. And one of the things I love about the movie, we could spend hours on this, is that John Smith, played by Colin Farrell, really is the iconic American hero in that film. He's the explorer. Yes. He's the individualist. He will go and he will prove himself and he will find a new world. And he falls in love with Rebecca. And there comes that turning point where, as wonderful as their romance has been, he hears that call again. And he shuts down this interior monologue he's had throughout the film of the voice of conscience calling to him. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this voice within me, he keeps saying, that is calling me to what is best. Suddenly he realizes there's another new world he could go discover. And he goes and he lies to Rebecca. And everyone in the audience is going, this is supposed to be such a fantastic romance. Right. And in the final quarter of the film, if you want to think of it as a game of basketball, someone else is introduced onto the court, and she falls in love with him, and he wins. Mm-hmm. He's a Christian tobacco farmer. Interesting. You don't see many of those. And he, Rebecca's perspective on John Smith is that he was a god to her, but when she meets her, John Rolfe, played by Christian Bale, he is a tree. Yes. He is firmly rooted, and she can hold on to him, and he adores her. And so it's this complete subversion of the typical American romance, right, where it's the quiet servant of a man who wins the girl in the end.
And allows her to choose. Yeah. And allows her to choose in the moment. The Colin Farrell character chooses glory, his own individual sort of male questing glory. Mm-hmm. And the tree, the one who nurtures her and shelters her, allows her to choose. And really her flourishing is what he allows to happen.
Mm-hmm. And there's the tree again. He seems to like nature, doesn't he?
Which came earlier, actually, in the film The Thin Red Line, which comes between Days of Heaven and The New World. Yes. They all start flowing together as if they're all happening at the same time, or happening in the very same world, which is very interesting.
Yeah, which it ties perfectly into the Tree of Life as far as things happening both in the past, in the present, in the future, and all at the same time. Before we get into Tree of Life specifically as well, I'd like to talk about expectations in seeing film, how to watch, this film. I think some people might have gone to this film. It was a summer movie. Mm-hmm. Might have been expecting Michael Bay, another Transformers.
It did have Brad Pitt in it, right?
Brad Pitt, Sean Penn, come on, right? Some American theaters actually set up signs warning moviegoers about the enigmatic and non-linear narrative of the movie. Did this at following some confused walkouts and refund demands from their customers in the opening weeks. Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, in the movie shows a lot, we talk about what you should be doing when you watch a film. Really, how do you do that? But it's especially true for this director and this film in particular.
Right. So, because it won Palme d'Or at Cannes. And so I think that may have been, people thought, oh, it's the greatest movie out of Cannes, let's go see it. So his films tend not to necessarily have that sort of pre-award winning. Yeah. I imagine that they're the kind of films that in 20 or 50 years will say, we lived when a master was making art. But
and it had an overwhelming trailer. I mean, a lot of people described the preview as a great short film in itself. Right. And I think people were sort of, wow, well, that was amazing. And there's Sean Penn, and I recognize Brad Pitt. And so they put it on their must-see list. But I think most American moviegoers, you could say going to the movies for them is sort of like going to bubble tea or going to the soda fountain, and someone serves them a shot of whiskey. And they're like, whoa, that's the worst bubble tea I've ever had.
Yes, yes.
But it's something entirely different, and you can't judge it on the same, by the same standards. And so if you read, Michael Crichton or Dan Brown or J.K. Rowling, and you go and someone hands you a Walt Whitman poem, by those standards, you're not going to know what to do with that. So it's an entirely, not just a different genre, but a different form of art in a way than most American cinema. Right. However, then you get people turning backflips over this as though it's a revolution. And you realize that most people have not seen films from other countries or the films that are studied in film school, where you would learn that this is actually growing from this is growing from deep roots in great art films.
Yeah. So what would you add to that, Chris?
And I would, if I can just say the two names that I think are on everyone's lips, it would be Andrei Tarkovsky and Stanley Kubrick, of course. And I think many of us spent Jenny and I were saying, watching the film, going 2001, but also the simply the filmic, the imagery of Tarkovsky, who people are probably less familiar with, but who is clearly the fountainhead of the beauty of the slow natural world, the image, the slow, the leaf down the creek or the waving grass, that you can see Malick growing out of that iconography.
Well, great. There's a levitating woman in the autobiographical film that Tarkovsky made, which is the same thing here. So it's very interesting.
Let's get into it then. Let's get into True Life. It has been called a hymn to the glory of creation.
Yeah.
Portentously tedious. Mm-hmm. A divine pronouncement. Church via the planetarium. And a chore. Mm-hmm. Another critic said this. Disembodied voices narrate. The camera cuts from close-ups of faces to endless peaks into the sunlit sky where God lives. Blurred light in a dark void suggests creation, and digital dinosaurs have moments of weakness and compassion. And if all this makes perfect sense to you, your name must be Terrence Malick. Well, this movie starts out with a quote from Job, and it's not narrated. He's a big fan of narration. All of his films are narrated, and this is the only text we see other than the ending credits. And it is Job 38:4-7, which is, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy." And that's how it starts. Mm-hmm. And then you see a light. So what happens from there?
Oh, tell us.
Yes, tell us, Dr. Cheney. What exactly happens in this movie from there?
Well, I would say, if you were asking me in one of my film classes, I would say that you're looking at a multi-layered, poetic film that interleaves images that talk, that tell, and words that don't necessarily. Mm-hmm. And you have the idea of eternity and creation and how real human lives are both deeply significant in that life, but only a part of the kind of greater story. It's completely sacred and poignant. I had tears in my eyes many times, and several times I went, oh, what in the world is that dinosaur doing there? Mm-hmm. And so you have, so it makes you think. It makes you feel, but mostly it's like all good art. It makes you a sort of encounter. Mm. Really, it's like Heidegger. You have to go and be in its presence, and I think live it and live through what it's telling you.
Jeffrey, is there a storyline at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think the Job quote sets it up.
Yeah.
That's God's answer to a man who's been devastated and who is crying out for some kind of assurance or you know, let me know there's some kind of purpose here. Mm. And right away, we're introduced to Jack O'Brien, played by Sean Penn, who lives in this very cold, sort of postmodern environment, lots of glass, lots of sharp angles. If you see a tree, it's probably in a pot in the middle of a big skyscraper lobby or something. And he's very distraught, and he's talking with his dad on the phone, and he's clearly broken up over things from his past. And we slowly are let into his past. We're let into his mother's childhood, which I think is very interesting because we're getting his mother's monologue, mm-hmm. his mother's voice describing her childhood. Is that what he imagines she thought? Or are we really getting access to her mind?
Right.
We are let into his childhood, but before that, let me back up. While we're focusing on his parents, we share the moment when they find out that a member of the family has died.
That's right.
And we're not given specifics. There's a lot of argument about how he died, who delivered the message. But the heartache is obvious. And then we are catapulted back to the Big Bang or Let There Be Light or whatever you want to call it, the first word that spoke things into being. And we have this long section of speculation or imagination, visualization of the beginning of time and the formation of the stars and the formation of planets. And it's all very like what God says to Job about, mm-hmm.
Where were you
when I did this. Mm-hmm. And that's when people who haven't read about the movie are startled to see dinosaurs. And we get a little deleted scene from Jurassic Park where dinosaurs behave in a way that is entirely contrary to what we're used to.
It's a merciful dinosaur.
Maybe, mm-hmm. maybe. Either that or one dinosaur decides the other one doesn't look very tasty and moves right. on. We're not sure.
We're not sure. Mm-hmm.
But it has to mean something. I mean, every shot in this movie, you can connect to other things. Yeah. And that's where the real fun begins, is in not tracking the story, but in taking one scene and another and saying, what do these two things have in common? That's and great. Usually it's a visual connection.
Yes.
And we'll get into those fun things in our next segment. Thanks for joining us here at the Kindlings Muse. I'm Jenny Spohr with Dr. Chris Chaney and Jeffrey Overstreet. We'll be right back. I'm joined tonight with Jeffrey Overstreet and Dr. Christine Chaney. We're talking about the Tree of Life. And, you know, this is a ponderous film in many ways.
In a good way.
In a good way. In some, you know, some better than others. But, what I want to talk about right now is nature versus grace. Now, we start out with the film with that quote from Job about where were you? And then his voiceover starts, and it's the mother who is narrating, or the mother's voice. And she talks about nature versus grace, that grace is a choice. It's a choice to choose grace, or it's a choice to choose nature. And how we choose those things, or how our life will play out. How do you see that playing out in this film, competition almost between grace and nature?
I'll just briefly say that yes, one thing that maybe is, it's not troubling, but it's we start to get Saint Terry here. So some of the parts that are potentially weaker are the very traditional alliance of the mother, the female, mm-hmm. with grace and with mm-hmm. love and forgiveness. And not that that's wrong, but you get the sort of binary, and maybe that's our human brokenness, that the father is, but I want them to be men, and you always set them against me, and he's the way of success, and you have to be tough and make it in the world. And so he's sort of, you know, the voice of nature, per se. And so that, you know, kind of setting up that binary, even though it is a larger theme of the film, that could be, you know, it could be problematic that it's always the woman, the softer, the flowy earth mother, mm-hmm. who's always about grace. But certainly that's a bigger question of the whole film, yeah. wouldn't you mm-hmm. say, Jeff? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's worth asking if it's a fair division to say that nature is the opposite of grace, because right. if anybody is good at capturing images of grace in nature, it's right. Terrence Malick. However, the early in the film, in one of the Jack voiceovers, we hear, "Brother, mother, you are the one, or they're the ones who led me to you." He doesn't say father,
right?
And he's not talking about father. I think he's probably talking about God. Right. So I think when people talk about nature, grace, father, mother, we forget about the brother, who is a very mm-hmm. reconciling figure in the film. The father is very harsh, very legalistic, very you have to fight to succeed in this world. The mother, what does she say? She says, "Grace doesn't try to please itself. Accepts being slighted, forgotten, disliked. Accepts insults and injuries," and that seems very appealing and righteous. And yet you have the moment where Jack, as a boy, goes to her after her husband has just walked all over her and says, "Why don't you ever stand up to him? Mm-hmm. You know, and he sees his father as a role model in a way. And so now that he has the chance, he's going to walk all over her and just go disobey. You know, right. What are you going to do about it?
Right.
And so I think when he says, "Mother, father, you're always wrestling inside me," the movie leaves the question open.
Right.
Right. It doesn't resolve it at all.
Right.
It says that there, neither of these works. Mm-hmm. So what am I going to do? And you have to hope for something like the brother who is masculine and who is a fighter, mm-hmm. and yet who also knows the value of forgiveness.
He's also an artist. He's the musician.
Yeah, he's the musician.
He's the musician. And I thought it was really interesting that he was the naturally gifted one on the guitar. And
yeah, that's great.
The idea of song as the reconciler, mm-hmm. as well.
Well, it's interesting. It brings you back to Job when you're thinking about the book of Job, and Job having this devastation in his life and God answering Job, mm-hmm. by showing nature and the beauty, mm-hmm. with which Malick portrays nature in this film, mm-hmm. is almost a grace in, mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, explaining the death of a child by going all the way back to the conception of the universe, mm-hmm. To try and make sense of it. How does that play out for you guys?
Mm-hmm. Well, the creation of the cosmos sequence is full of violence, full of, mm-hmm. destruction. You know, you, mm-hmm. see a meteor strike the earth, and very soon we see the dinosaurs dying. And I think that all of those cosmic scenes can be tied to incidental scenes in the family drama.
Yeah.
You see a dinosaur refrain from harming another one, and later, maybe, as you were saying earlier, maybe by the very same creek, you see boys wrestling and trying to decide when too much fighting is cruelty, too much violence is cruelty, and when to hold back. There's a wonderful moment where Jack is arguing with his father, and his father says, "Well, maybe I've been too harsh on you sometimes." And Jack says, "It's your house. You do what you want." If you, mm-hmm. think, wow, if this is how Jack is thinking about his relationship with God now, mm-hmm. is that how we really want to end our conversation with God? You know, with all the evil we see in the world? Well, it's your house.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it's a question of a movie.
Right, right. And I love, you know, getting back to Heidegger, but I, mm-hmm. promise not to say only one more thing about him. One of his claims, which is, I think, really key for Malick, and I think we can't avoid it because there's so many voiceovers, there's so much, it's prayer, it's thought. You know, it's the life of the mind in his films. And Heidegger said that is what we know is both what we experience in the material world, but also what we think and what we feel and what we pray and what we say in our heads, and that life is encompassed in both the inner and the outer. And it seems so key for Malick that, as Jeff and I were saying earlier, in this film, it's both prayer, it's thought. But in other films, people think one thing and do the very thing they don't want to. Mm-hmm. You know, and Malick seems to really be about, what is it that we humans, you know, why are we like this? Why do we know this? We think this, we act this way. You know, how do you make sense of that?
Yeah.
Literally, cosmically, mm-hmm. that these brothers are like creation, are like dinosaurs, are like the future, are like heaven. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting way to sort of ponder one family's life. Yeah. My one small life, mm-hmm. in that bigger sense.
And that quote from Romans is paraphrased in the narration.
Yeah.
Of, I do not do what I want to do, but I do what I hate.
Yeah.
And that's the, you know, boy, the Sean Penn character as a boy. You know, it's a movie that asks a lot of those big questions right in the narration. Where were you?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Did you know? You know, asking God, did you know that when my son was born, you were going to kill him off? You know, type of question. Who are we to you? Why should I be good if you are not?
Mm-hmm. 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 And yet we culminate with the moment where the mother, pictured as though she's the Virgin Mary,
yeah.
is saying, I give you my son.
This is my son.
I mean, and that's one of the most blatantly religious, if you will, or recognizably religious,
right. mm-hmm.
Images in the film.
That and the feet of Jesus in heaven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now, we're getting into this topic of the spirituality in the film. Is
right.
this a Christian movie? It's been coined, as I said earlier, as one of the most overtly mainstream Christian movie since Passion of the Christ. Others are saying that it's not that way. Roger Ebert called the entire movie a form of prayer.
Yep.
As you've said, Malick is an Episcopalian. How is that this playing into this movie? How is Christianity and the God of Christianity, as we would perhaps understand that God, playing into this film? Where do you see that?
Well, I think he does sort of a road to Emmaus kind of thing, where if your eyes are open for Jesus, you will see him. But I have read, you know, reviews by scholarly writers who have seen it and say, this is Terrence Malick in a crisis of faith, saying that he has concluded that humans are so insignificant to God that God is just doing what he's going to do, and if it wipes us out, it wipes us out. He's got bigger things on his mind. And it's actually kind of hard to argue with that watching the film. There are moments when the characters feel reconciliation and love and hope, and I think for me it ends on a very hopeful note when you see the subtle expression on Sean Penn's face. But I think it's a credit to Malick that he makes it so spacious that he gives good attention to all of our moods, all of our experiences at some time. I mean, tonight I might be feeling great hope because of something that happened today, and tomorrow at some point I might be saying, what in the world were you doing there? like the Israelites.
Yes, right. And that's what's so amazing about this film, coming back to that, is that you really can, like faith, like life, the more, you know, you can re-see it, you see it several times, all the ways that we humans wrestle with those questions are wonderfully, poetically rendered there in these kind of ways where, as you were saying earlier, where one image will have a partnered image later, we'll have another one, we'll have the question of doubt and violence and why do we do wrong, why do we love, why do we suffer?
So is the quote-unquote New Testament God missing from this movie? Is this just an Old Testament God, a Jobian view of God, a judgment God in the beginnings of Jeremiah?
Oh, no.
Really? Well, tell us.
I keep mentioning, so I will just go ahead.
Go for it.
At the end, I mean, you simply have Ingmar Bergman's heaven, which is a kind of beach in gray northern climate. Seriously, I thought we were in Sweden at some point. But it's truly, I mean, here we are restored. Here is the brother who's been lost. Here is the brokenness, the father. They're all restored. And the Sean Penn character, you know, we don't see the rest of the figure, but it's Christ, it's an angel. We see him kneel and kiss as he enters into this time where all are restored and love. And I mean, that to me was so poignant, that even with the loss of the brother and the hurt and the hard things we do to each other and families in real life, in the end, that kind of grace and mercy and restoration. I mean, it was the hope of heaven to me in the end.
I still struggle with the idea of that being a representation of heaven, so because the only people that are there or really focused on are those from his own life. But he also sees himself at different stages.
Yes.
It's his younger self leading him to the door early in the film and finally through the door into this understanding. And so whether it's heaven or just a momentary state of grace when he's able to reconcile with the father that was and the father that is now, the boy he was and the boy he is now, is I think it's part of this vision that's given to him as he is descending. And this is really interesting, too. At the beginning of the film, he's going up to the top of a skyscraper. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Throughout his childhood, he's looking up at everything. But in adulthood, he's looking down on the world. And the vision of the creation of the world comes as he's descending back down to earth.
Yeah.
And he walks out and seems to have found some kind of hope. So whether that's heaven or just some kind of promise, I'm not sure. But back to your question about, is it Christian?
Yes.
We've been over that question about that label so many times here. But watching the movie reminded me of this from Flannery O'Connor. So much better to get her words out here than mine. The Christian writer or the Christian artist does not decide what would be good for the world and proceed to deliver it. Like a very doubtful Jacob, he confronts what stands in his path and wonders if he will come out of the struggle at all. Mm-hmm. And that's what I feel Malick's experience is working all this out. He's not delivering a message to us.
Right.
He's struggling with this and wondering wondering if he's going to come out of it at all. Mm. And so if that is Christian art, then sure. Unfortunately, that's a very rare kind of experience in the realm of Christian art.
So why do you think that I could not find a single critic online that liked the ending, that liked this beach scene where they all appear and they got, you know, they were saying it was cliche, it was this, but not a single person I read or listened to liked this ending. They all thought it was horrible. What are your thoughts? Why do you think they didn't like it? I mean, are they just jaded? Do they not understand? What's...
Well, maybe our fellow critic can answer, but for me, it's, you know, how could you possibly say that in a film that has dinosaurs and the creation of the cosmos and, you know, trees and Texas? It's simply, to me, I thought he has earned in his body of work a visual language as the kind of filmmaker that he is. And my first reaction when that film ended was, well, this one, he just totally went for it. This isn't obliquely about spiritual or why do we do or violence or good and evil. He just said, cards on the table, right? And here's my language. I do think other filmmakers are in that beach scene. Here's grace or hope or a moment or the or heaven. And this is going to be my visual language to evoke something for which we really... You know, other than clouds, you know, I'm thinking of Bugs Bunny with, you know, a harp on a cloud. What, you know, how do we render, you know, why not simply say, here's the natural world in a totally different way? I mean, here's water and light, but not the same sort of vocabulary of water and light that he has used before as a sort of other place.
Do you think it's because that language of faith is so missing in film? And by that, I don't mean the sort of... you know, facing the giants type of thing, but there's a language of faith artistically done that's lacking in that maybe critics are reacting to because they've never seen something like this. What are your thoughts?
And it's not even a language of faith so much as just a language of poetry, that this is a metaphorical sequence.
Right.
Like the opening with the adult Jack is very metaphorical as well. You wouldn't say, oh, that's Philadelphia or whatever. It's kind of a weird postmodern city he's living in, almost science fiction.
Yeah.
So we're supposed to be thinking about what things represent there, not think of them literally. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people had trouble with that. Where I can sympathize with some of the trouble that people have with it is that it's towing the line of sentimentality to end any movie with a whole crowd of people on a beach hugging each other.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you going to pull that off without it looking a little corny? On top of that, if you know anything about Malick's method, you know, he sort of turns his actors loose and then just wanders around with the camera, and if he catches a great moment, he catches a great moment. A lot of people were going, well, there's Malick doing what he does best, turning a whole bunch of actors loose with no direction, just wander.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what it looks like. Like a lot of actors walking around going, I will now go into the shallow water, and I will now walk back to the beach. So I had a little trouble taking it seriously just because it just looked like a bunch of people with aimless.
Dinosaurs, now zombies. What are we dealing
with? Yeah, very good.
Perhaps.
Yeah, that's exactly.
I must be the only person in America who thought that was okay.
No.
If you think of the end of The Seventh Seal, okay, so we have people black and white on a hillside and they just walk off. Mm-hmm. They're holding hands.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think maybe it didn't work for you, but to me it was the other land. It's a whole other land that is that... You know, there is something else, and we're going to it. And maybe it's more like, maybe actually it's purgatory. It might be more limbo. That's why they're wandering around.
Bergman lives there, though. I mean,
yes.
Your whole movie
yes.
is in that kind of thing.
Yes.
This movie has such specific, realistic moments of a boy's experience in Texas that to suddenly step there is a bit of a leap. And on top of that, and then this is one of my problems with the film, is most of the movie we're in Jack's point of view, hearing Jack's thoughts, seeing through Jack's eyes his experiences. What are these few moments at the beginning and at the end when we're suddenly allowed access to his mother's interior monologue?
Yeah.
And that confuses me, because I'm like, okay, is this Jack guessing at what his mother might have experienced, or is the movie suddenly expanding the field so we can get into their lives too? And if so, I want to hear the father's interior monologue more. We get the mother's childhood.
Yeah.
We don't get anything about the father's upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I wonder if there isn't some truth to the rumors of a six-hour version of this film on the way, which only I will watch, probably. But
we'll watch it together.
Hopefully, we'll experience more of the other characters.
Well, and this is one of the first films that he's had narration for more than one point of view, as well. I was pleasantly surprised by her voiceovers, and I wonder, we've touched on it a bit. There's been a bit of talk about how this is a male-focused film, but I wonder if adding, as you said, it's a little bit of the stereotype of the woman being Grace and people can walk all over me and I'll just be this doormat and that's what Grace is. But I think there's a little bit more to it than that.
Right. And one thing I wanted to say, not being a boy, so I think I'm, of course, the perfect person to say it. No. That, as we were talking about earlier, I know from my husband and other men who've seen it, the relationship of the boys together and the fathers and sons. Mm. We know men who've tears have been brought to their eyes. And I know, like I said, my husband's own experience with his brothers and the love and cruelty that gets inflicted, that I just really wanted to say that a depiction of boyhood in that film is a really very much a sort of warm flesh and blood part of this film that sounds so abstract and philosophical. Those actors, first off, but the lives of boys and their fathers and the relationship between boys and brothers, I think is deeply important to even those larger claims he's making about doubt and cruelty and love and forgiveness. Mm-hmm. But if he didn't render it when you little brother trusts you one time, and then later when he trusts you, you shoot his finger with a BB gun and you hurt him on purpose. Mm-hmm. I know that's brought tears to more than one man I know's eyes who, I've been that boy. I know that moment. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about then what that character, that boy, mm-hmm. does after, to in a sense ask for forgiveness, to atone, to redeem.
What about the role of motherhood? How, as a mom yourself, how did that come across to you in this film?
That was also lovely about how much the mother modeled the idea of love, that nothing matters more, that sort of mercy and forgiveness and love, it has to be the glue that holds, it has to be the more than. You wouldn't care that you shot your brother's finger and cry and weep over being cruel if you didn't also love him, and how love, she models in that sort of, Mary-like way that to love means to suffer, but it doesn't mean we don't love, right?
Yeah. That's great. All right, thank you, Dr. Chris Chaney and Jeffrey Overstreet. We'll have more on the Tree of Life at the Kindlings Muse here at Hales Ales Brewery and Pub. Take it down. We're going to take it down now, people.
Take it down.
Welcome back to the Kindlings Muse. I'm your host tonight, Jenny Spohr. And while I do not, unfortunately, live on an island, I'm sure you will all come up with an overused phrase that I will use that you can all drink to, as we have with our host, Dick Snub. Okay, now is our favorite time of the show. We go and throw open the microphone willy-nilly to our audience, who always have great, deep, thoughtful questions to ask. And so, panel, get ready. Okay, we're heading over here to Steve at table two. If I can, with my gigantic 8-month pregnant belly, get through the chairs here without knocking someone unconscious. Steve, your question, please, sir.
Okay. I'm curious about what you think the role of music was in the film. I'm thinking particularly of examples like the Lacrimosa during the creation scenes, and also like the Agnus Dei that was there in towards the end.
And
stuff
the
like
Mahler.
Oh. Well, and the Smetana as well. So yeah.
Yeah. Yes, music in the film plays a huge role.
Could we have missed the music, Jeff?
Go for it. Oh, you're ready to go.
Okay, because clearly I was. Seriously, especially for something phenomenological that is literally trying to encompass that idea of all the things that make life, all the senses on it. Of course, music is so important to Malick. And that, I thought that film, that was, you know, I'm sort of gushing. The amazing use of that as a kind of text as well. I won't even say narrative, like the visual text, like the nature, like the narrative, like the thought. You know, the music was a huge key component, and you know, resonating when we had, you know, the suffering, the Agnus Dei, when you have the, you know, Mahler, who said a symphony should be a world, right? And so, you know, the whole entire thing is this kind of rendered universe, and all the pieces. I mean, that's so clearly crucially important to him as a filmmaker. So mm-hmm. I'm mostly just saying yes, mm-hmm. key. And I think there'll be many a, you know, future film study dissertation on, you know, breaking down films and the use of the music to key to those themes.
And it might be one of those movies that someday they have other artists compose alternate soundtracks to and things, because music can change the images you're looking at so dramatically. I just did this in a film workshop where we watched a short film and then we watched it again and I put on like Dixieland jazz. And they really thought they were watching a different version of the film, because the pictures looked so different. I'm not a music historian, so I can't speak to the history of those pieces or why he chose them. All I can say is that they're enthralling, and it's one of the rare pleasures of seeing something in a big surround sound theater. And this is one of the things. It's like, yeah, yes, it's coming out. Yeah, I'm sure it will look great on Blu-ray, but if you didn't see that in a big theater with a great projector and a great sound system, you're missing out on half the experience. And you can tell it's not just classical music. He's really drawn to great composers. He includes a couple of pieces by Zbigniew Priesner, who is a film composer who was Krzysztof Kieslowski's great collaborator, really. I mean, the Colors trilogy, or Blue, by itself, without Priesner, it just wouldn't have worked. I mean, what do you say to a composer when you say, okay, I need you to compose a symphony representing the reunification of Europe as composed by the world's greatest living composer in the film? You know, so he knows great music, and
or the use of the Orff in Badlands, the Carl Orff. I mean, how crucial that was.
Or the Ring in the New World.
The Wagner. Yeah.
Now he's notorious for infuriating film composers because he puts them to work scoring his films, and then at the last minute changes his mind and replaces those soundtracks with classical music. And James Horner is still upset, I think, about having this huge score he composed for The New World being pretty much entirely, almost entirely replaced in the last stages of that film. He does this with actors too, but that's a long story.
I actually sang in choirs when I was younger, and just listening to the Lacrimosa in this film and knowing that that's a traditional song used in death masses, and that it's underlying this creation that's going on. You're watching the nebula and all these things, and this woman is screaming Lacrimosa. Mm-hmm. And then of course at the beast with Agnus Dei, and you know, blood of the lamb that takes away the sins of the world. Mm-hmm. Beautiful use of music there. Corey, put down your iPhone, woman. I told you to turn that off. Oh, it's I don't know if I believe you. Here, darling.
Okay. Please say more if you want to about the faraway first mover god versus the personal god in this and other films, say Tender Mercies, other movies like that.
Ooh. Good question.
So a far-off creator, where were you? Almost deistic sort of God versus a personal God in this film and in others.
Jeff?
Well, I think one of the disciplines Malick is trying to train moviegoers to understand is what we see on the grand scale is also what's happening on in a microscopic scale, that the collisions of these celestial bodies is also what's happening in this child's life. And so where we might be inclined to say, well, there's the faraway God in the cosmos creating things, and he doesn't care about humankind. But then Malick brings you into the most intimate details of their lives, and you realize there are parallels there. I think you have to say that if that's God doing that, then this is God here too. And there is no division. It's all part of the same thing. Other films, I don't know, The Apostle springs to mind, one where the character Reverend Dewey, played by Robert Duvall, is raging at God, where are you now? But then we see God in the grace that he carries out in the lives of others. Have you seen Of Gods and Men, which came out this year? Earlier this year, there was a question earlier tonight about whether this was the most blatantly Christian film of the year. Right. And I'd say Of Gods and Men is pretty clearly about monks who choose to stay and serve an endangered people when extremists, Muslim extremists, move into Algeria, right? They choose to stay and serve. And Roger Ebert reviewed that film and said he did not understand the monk's decision. He thought it was selfish and prideful. I thought, did you not watch the movie where they're talking about how they desperately want to flee, but they feel that they are the branch on which these people are living, and if they leave, everything will fall apart? It's entirely sacrificial and selfless. So that is, again, showing that what might seem like a God that they are just sort of worshiping out there becomes manifest in their example of service.
And maybe I would add, is that I noticed that when we ask this question, sometimes we have, there's the Father God and then God the Son, but we don't often talk about God the Spirit, the third part of the Trinity. And I often think of Malick that he's, I'm not going to speak for him, but my response to his body of work is that this is a kind of embodied sacred, like the spirit that is God with us, the encourager, the one who we encounter in prayer and in our thought and our life. And then it's the God, the ineffable God that we don't, we don't have, say, an image for. And yet we is it music? Is it love? Is it prayer? And so I don't want to speak for him, but I often think he's reaching for a way to bring in the third part of the Trinity that we have less of a sort of vocabulary for that part of the Godhead that's God with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't seen Higher Ground yet, but you mentioned that one earlier, and that's out right now. And that's about someone trying to make sense of her idea of God and Christian community's idea of God. Malick's almost an answer to Bergman, really, who his God is always hard to connect with and way out there. Mm-hmm. Kieślowski's idea of God is much more subtle than Malick's, but I think in the music, in the light of his films, there's a sense of the spirit at work.
There's definitely that sense of a ruach, the breath of God, almost the inhalation and exhalation of God in this movie. Yeah, definitely. Laura, you had a great question.
And tags on what you just said quite nicely, I think.